Please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
For yesterday, prayer day of silence. There's some copies on the way out if you like. Its title is Expect a Miracle Today. Expect God to reveal himself today. Expect God to heal an injury today. Expect God to fill you with peace and bliss today. Expect God to bring solace to all those who mourn. Expect God to be with you in your silent heart today. And always expect a miracle today. We had a wonderful retreat up at Loon Lake, and in part we took a look at and were studying Sri Yukteswar's Turn of the Yugas, and I saw this picture that was a picture of looking from our Earth towards the center of our galaxy. And it's just remarkable when you see these pictures that I remember one of them was a picture, and all you saw were 10,000 points of light out there. And each one of those points of light was not a solar system. Each one was a galaxy filled with thousands of stars. We live in a fantastical universe here. At Loon Lake Retreat, we took Sri Yukteswar's Holy Science, and in particular, we focused on eight meannesses of the heart. And when Ruth first showed up, she was there already. She'd been teaching classes that she does in her nursing classes up there at Loon Lake the week before. And one of the nurses, she had been talking about what are counterindications. And she says, I don't want to hear anything counter. I only want to hear things pro. This is what the students were saying. I don't want to think anything negative. So when she asked me what the title for the talk and the work was going to be Eight Meannesses of the Heart, she just cracked up laughing, and so she said, well, I guess I have my answer. Reading from Genesis chapter 4, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I have gotten man from the Lord. And she again bare his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel he also brought the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance falling? If thou doest well, shalt that now be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, and that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. And the Lord said unto Cain, Where is Abel, thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now thou art cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth. This is a fascinating saying, filled with meaning. When we think of the divine consciousness within each one of us, and that in the beginning, Adam and Eve, representing reason and feeling, walked with God in the garden, there was perfect communion within the Son of Man, also reflected as the Son of God. The Garden of Eden represents that perfect concert between the divine and the human. Through freedom of choice, Eve, representing feeling, was tempted by the serpent. Now the serpent is downward facing in the tree. And this takes the life energies and consciousness to the lower regions of the spine, which are the lower consciousness, having more to do with the body. And ultimately, at the far furthest reaches, has to do with survival and with sexual desire. Through the awakening of this sense of duality, the fruit of good and evil that the body represents and body consciousness represents, Adam and Eve bit into that fruit and tasted of it. They entered into that realm of duality. Before, everything was filled with divine splendor. Now they recognize there are things that were of God and things not of God. And so when God metaphorically was walking through the garden, he was looking for Adam and Eve, and they were hiding. Why were they hiding? Because they were ashamed and they were afraid. Why were they ashamed? Because they realized now they were naked. Before, you can stand naked before God and you don't feel any sense of withdrawing from him. But when we come into the world of duality, when we come into the world of separation from the divine, then we feel as if that shame and fear are very much a part of our beings, and we hide. We want to push the divine away. We want to keep all consciousness and act as if we can exist as an individual separate from God. As a result of their actions, in the way that it's described in the story of Genesis, God threw Adam and Eve out. But I think what is more accurate to say is that through their choices, they removed themselves from the garden. And as they moved out, they spawned different children from them, from their ignorance of separation. Cain and Abel. Now, Abel was of the sheep. And as we know from the parables of Jesus and others, that the sheep and the shepherd represent positive virtues. Now, Jesus talked about the sheep being on the right hand and the goats being on the left. I'm not quite sure why the goats get the short end of the stick, but they become symbolic for what is left-handed or what goes against divine consciousness, the negativity. And the sheep represent the positivity. Cain tilled the ground. He was of the earth. He's of the body. And he is body consciousness, and he represents that. And so in body consciousness, we do what we want to do all through the day. We burn out this life force, and as Mother said, we end up giving God burnt offerings. So what is given then from Cain is unacceptable to God because it has already been burnt out through the body. Whereas Abel is presenting this purity of the sheep. and chief consciousness are the positive virtues within himself and offering those up to God first, and those God finds acceptable. And so Cain rises up. Cain is body consciousness, and Cain slews Abel. He slews that tendency towards the good and towards God and towards that which offers up to God that which is acceptable. Deep in meditation, when you successfully withdraw the life force from this body and from the preoccupations of this world, you then draw all those energies up and you give it as a virginal gift to God. It has not been used up at this point because you are taking pure life energy as has been given to you, and you are offering it up to God, and it exalts you, it lifts you into higher regions of heavenly consciousness. And this is what is acceptable, but in Cain consciousness, all that is gone. Now you are living for the body. And the body even doesn't yield up its strength to you as it once did, because you dissipate it, and you become dissipated yourself. You become addicted to those things of the body. It's really something when somebody who is otherwise a good person, you would say, but they become obsessed. They become sexually obsessed with another person, and all of their thoughts and all of their energies runs towards that person. They can't think of another thing, and oftentimes, as we know about, either from our own experience or from those that we read about or those that we know, you can be a married person, you can have committed relationship, you can be in relationship with somebody else who is married and committed, and yet all this energy runs not towards the one that you've committed to, but towards another. And it's a difficult thing when this kind of obsession takes you over. It completely takes you, and all your energies run in that direction. And you have to fight it. You have to really do everything in your power not to give in to this and to stay true. Stay true first to yourself, not to lose yourself in this energy. This is Cain consciousness that's run amok. It's totally taken everything to the body. A sociopath is another example, one who has lost all sense of conscience. They will do anything and everything that serves themselves, but not another, but not another. And so Cain rises up in anger, wrath is anger. And so this idea of anger is something that we also read about at another time in the Bible, in the New Testament. And this has to do with Jesus. And this comes from Master's Discourse number 12 in the Second Coming of Christ, driving the money changers out of the temple. The scripture reading comes from John chapter 2. After this, he went down to Capernaum, and he and his mother and his brethren, or his brothers, and his disciples, and they continued there not many days. And the Jews' Passover was at hand. And Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables, and said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my Father's house a house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it is written, the zeal of thine house has eaten me up. Now we can ask, is this a case of Jesus getting wroth, getting angry, losing his cool, losing his sense of temper? Let us see what Master says. Meekness is not weakness. A true exemplar of peace is centered in his divine self. All actions rising therefrom are imbued with the soul's non-peril vibratory power, whether issuing forth as a calm command or a strong volition. Notwithstanding minds might critique, not understanding minds, might critique Jesus confronting the temple mercenaries with a scourge as contradicting his teaching, resist not evil, but whatsoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him also the other. The forceful use of a whip to drive out the merchants and money changers out of the house of worship may not seem wholly in keeping with the propagated lamb-like image of Jesus, who taught forbearance and love. The actions of divine personalities, however, are sometimes willfully startling to shake complacent minds out of their vacuous acceptance of the commonplace. An accurate sense of spiritual propriety in a world of relativity requires a ready wit and steady wisdom. The proper course of behavior is not always discerned by scripture-quoting dogmatists whose literal dependence on inflexible dictums may pay homage to the letter rather than the spirit of spirituality in action. One of the eight meannesses of the heart that we were examining was hatred. Now, in the first case, with Cain and Abel, where did Cain's anger come from? He made an offering to God and found that it was not acceptable, and that's when he got angry. Why did he get angry? Because he did it when he made that offering. He did it with the anticipation that God was going to be pleased and was going to give him something, perhaps, in return for what he had offered. Now, at the center of this, at the source of it all, is an attachment. And I think we will find this is true for all anger. That when we are in a situation and we anticipate a certain result, a certain reaction, a response from another person or from the situation, and we get something other than what we anticipated, we anticipate getting some money, or we get praise, or we get we are received well some place, and none of that happens. And so we have a difference between what we're anticipating and what actually happens. And when that difference occurs, we feel a frustration of our desire. Now, if that frustration is allowed to grow, it turns into an anger. And if that anger continues to grow, it can turn into hatred. And if that hatred continues to grow, we want revenge. And then we can lose our reason, we can lose any kind of spiritual perception of the situation, and become completely lost in a world of anger, hatred, and revenge. So this is very powerful stuff that we are talking about. And it is things that occur all the time. It is an interesting situation at the retreat where one of the individuals had a difficult time with the 24 hours of silence that we had while we were there. It was not what he is anticipating. He is thinking something else. In fact, he'd been looking forward to chatting with others and making connection. Felt like that he lived out of the loop of things, and this was his opportunity. And so when the notion of 24 hours of silence, there was time in the beginning and at the end to talk with others, but we held that for 24 hours of the time where we were quiet. And as happens, not just talking about that individual, it's just using this situation as an example, because it happens to all of us. And an inner anger began to build in him, and this feeling of resentment. And then the statement, well, if this is the way these retreats are going to go, I'm not going to bother to come. And isn't this a way that we oftentimes respond when things don't go our way. Well, if that's the way it's going to be, I'm not going to participate. I'm not going to show up. And not showing up can take a lot of different varieties. In talking to another individual after the retreat, there was some disharmony between husband and wife. And this individual realized that they were withholding themselves from the relationship because they were mad. Now, David Schnarch, who's a family therapist type, and he calls this normal marriage sadism. And isn't it the truth? You don't like what somebody does, whether it's a married partner or not. And so you decide to withhold from them. I know they want me to do this, and I'm just not going to do it, or I'm not going to jump to their tune quite so quickly. I may do it when I feel like getting around to it. But suddenly we find ourselves withholding ourselves from another because they didn't do exactly what we wanted them to do. The cost to us individually of all of this is it separates us, first of all, from God. Because when you're filled with anger, when you're filled with resentment and ideas of revenge, you are not filled with the feeling and the bliss and the joy of God. Now, Jesus' situation is very interesting because to all appearances, I mean, tying some cords together and tying knots in them, that's premeditated, isn't it? And he very intentionally set out to drive these people out of the temple and to make a point with an exclamation point. And so you wonder, was he really mad? Was he really angry? What was he feeling at the time? This is my view of it, is that when you are acting in divine consciousness, you can act powerfully. You can act strongly. But inwardly, you feel detached. You feel that this is God's wrath that is flowing through you, not from you. Now, this is not excuse-making. Somebody who gets into a fit and they say, well, I guess that was just God's will running through me, but there was no sense of God consciousness at the time. They were just running amok and later on justified it by saying that's God's wrath. That's a complete misuse of this teaching. But it is possible to inwardly remain detached, to feel this righteous indignation to rise up in you and to express it because that's what's needed for the situation. A strong statement is what is necessary. I remember reading a story of Papa at the ashram, and there is one sadhu who was not behaving correctly. They didn't go into any details in recounting the story, but he was harassing some of the ladies there. He was doing some things that were definitely wrong. And Papa had finally heard enough, and he got up and he went with a small group to have an encounter with this man. And he was in his room, and Papa knocked on the door, and no answer, and he knocked some more, and no answer still. And finally the man showed up, and he'd been shaving his head. And perhaps he wasn't quite right in the head, I don't know. But Papa said, you're going to have to leave, you're not been behaving properly. And the man said, nothing doing. I'm staying. This ashram is for me. And so Papa then said what became very insistent and demanded that he leave. And the man was refusing. And Papa started kicking at the man, physically kicking at him and pushing him until the man left the grounds. There were some who were standing there who observed Papa in this state, and they ended up leaving the ashram because they believed that Papa was not who he said he was, that he was attached, that he had become angry at this person and had lost control. Papa, of course, was unperturbed by their leaving because he knew. He knew inside of him that it was not done out of attachment, even though he said that anger and rage were the most difficult things for him to overcome. And that it took years, and he described at one point where he was chanting God's name and walking through the jungles, and he literally just fell onto the ground in a fit of rage. And I identified with that when I read that, because even though I felt through much of my life that I was not an angry person, in fact, I didn't even think I had much anger. But one day in meditation, I just had such a tremendous rage boil up inside of me, and I just threw myself down on the ground and was just hitting the ground with my fists and my feet, and it was a terrific thing. And afterwards, I felt completely wrung out by the experience, but that was something that had been residing deep within me. So we have, because we have attachment to this body, even as Cain did, we have that sense of rage that's deep down, and sometimes people express it very freely, and to whomever and wherever they want. And others, like myself, were more what would be called passive-aggressive. When you're passive-aggressive, aggressive means you're angry, but passive means you're not direct about it. You take it out in other ways. You decide, oh, I'm not going to be on time when I go places. I'm not going to show up to that meeting on time because the boss frustrates me. And so I'm just going to do these little things. I'm going to withhold myself. I'm not going to take it on directly because either I feel that I can't or it's just not my pattern to do so. So I take it out in these little subterfuge kind of ways. And so you can become an angry, rageful person, or you can become quite not diligent in doing what you should do. And you don't even recognize that it's anger that you're acting out. You just think, well, I don't care about getting there on time, so I'm not going to do it. And you don't. But when you look underneath the surface, you find out, ah, I really am. This is anger that's coming out in this sideways way. It's not direct. And so we all experience anger, and we all experience rage at times, because we feel that the world should be different than what it is. I think that most people are in a running argument with God about how He runs His universe. We don't like it. We don't like that life is so hard, that things don't come easier than what they do, that people don't bow down to our feet more often than they do, that they even have the audacity to give us a hard time. And we feel frustrated by that. And if we get frustrated, we feel angry. And that anger can just burn inside like a seething rage. It's just a volcano underneath the surface. I used to work with a men's group. Most of them were court-ordered in for anger management. And part of the questionnaire was, were you angry today? And if so, that put it on a scale of 1 to 10, how angry? And it's always amazing to me, out of a group of 20 or 25 men sitting in this room, most always it was all men, and they would report, I was angry today, and I was feeling anger of a 9 or a 10, and I wonder, how could they sit in this room? They look so passive while they were here. It was just a volcano waiting to explode. And so learning how to deal with this anger, not through sideways subterfuge and not through exploding through anger all the time, is a very important thing. First of all, just acknowledging that the anger is there when you're feeling it, that it's there. And then learning to deal with it directly. Now, what God gave to me one time was that just like in a house, electricity flows into a house, and some of the electricity flows to the lighting. If a switch is thrown, some will go towards the heating, some will go through to perhaps air conditioning or fans, to the TV, to the stereo. It goes to all these different uses. But the electricity itself is, you might say, a neutral medium. It doesn't mind which direction it gets thrown in. It's just moving through as you flip the switch. And life energy in you is the same way. And when it gets channeled through anger or through love, through selfless service or through complete selfishness, the life energy flows. It flows. Now, you can deplete yourself, and you can get to the point like with Cain, where it just starts to dissipate you to a great degree, and your body will end up not functioning, and you will have terrible illnesses and depletion of energy and all the rest of it. But when we learn to manage pranayama, when we learn to manage this life force that's flowing through us, we learn to at least give it away in a way that neutralizes the charge that is upon a particular situation. So learning how to go for a walk when you're feeling enraged, to writing things out, to talking things out in a non-yelling kind of a way, just working it out through talking it out. Or finding positive purposes, going out to the woodpile and cutting some wood for a while, or cleaning the house, or doing other kinds of things that will actually positively channel that energy and move it through. So that you aren't repressing it, you're not sitting on it. And you're also not doing something that's destructive with it. When we speak words out of anger and being controlled by anger, we will say things, number one, that are not true. They may technically be true, but there'll be a distortion of that truth. There'll be an exaggeration of that truth, and we will say things and call people names that we ordinarily wouldn't say. When you are guided by truth, as Jesus was, you speak the truth. There's not a moment of being out of control. You're a complete and total self-master of all these energies flowing through you. And so there is not a time when afterwards you think, oh, I guess I overstated that, or I wish I hadn't said that, because it's not completely true. It's a distortion of the truth, and when you are master of yourself, you know that as you speak those words, there's a vibration that goes out with it, there's a consciousness that goes out with it, and it's all attuned and aligned with truth. I noticed this with Mother many times. She could speak very powerfully to people, very directly, but never once did I see her out of control. Never once did I see where the emotion ruled her. She was using what came to her, and it was a vastly interesting thing to watch, that she would be operating out of a very high level of consciousness. And somebody would attack her with some kind of, oftentimes, a question. A question can seem innocent enough, but really it's loaded. It's loaded for bear. And I could see her shift in her consciousness, and she would come right down to that person's level, not in a negative way, but so that she could speak to them exactly from where they were speaking from, but in her case, from total truth. And she would meet them like for like. She was not meek in a weak kind of a way. Meek means surrendered. Meek means you understand that it is God's life, God's intelligence, God's power that flows through you. And there's nothing else in this universe that counts. And when you know that, why would you deal with life any less? Why would you let anger and rage and wrath rule you? That in no way is being a spiritual master. And so she spoke the truth, but she would meet that individual exactly where they came from. And sometimes people wouldn't like it. Sometimes people observing wouldn't understand it. And it could be uncomfortable for everybody. But it was a discomfort to dislodge the human ego, and everybody that was within range of hearing and seeing this could benefit from it if they accepted it as coming from God, as if she is divinely inspired. And this gets to the root of our attachment. We feel that what another person is saying or doing, when it frustrates our desire and our attachment, is not coming from God. Now, if we explore Papa's life through his inquest of God and in the vision of God, we get a wonderful window into a view of divine consciousness. Now, what did Papa do when he encountered others who were clearly coming from a lower stage of consciousness? One is, he always saw God in that individual. He beheld God. And he always, in his words and in his deeds, sought to uplift that individual into divine consciousness. He didn't accept anything less. Not at all. And so oftentimes people rose up to the level that he was dealing with them on. They would be startled. They would be shocked sometimes. He would call them God. I remember the policeman that he was speaking to. And he was deriding Papa, and he says, "What, God is everywhere? Where is he in this room? Where is he in this room? Just show me." And God reached out his hand and patted the police chief on the chest and said, "Right here in your heart." And the man melted and changed in consciousness. And his whole attitude shifted right then. Because Papa was seeing, perceiving, and knowing that God was within that individual. He was not put off by his brusque manner. And so he always operated in that divine consciousness. Now, this doesn't mean he always did what the people around him wanted him to do. There were occasions when people had such love and attachment for Papa, they didn't want him to leave. And they actually would lock him up and tell him that he couldn't leave. Can you imagine such a thing? They made him prisoner of their love. And they'd say, "Papa, this is God in this form saying, you may not leave. You have to stay here. You have to stay with us. You cannot leave." And Papa would say, "Ram Dass knows that you are God, but he feels God inside, and God inside is what he listens to, and God inside says he must leave." And there were instances where Papa actually had to sneak out of the window and escape from the place in order to get away. Isn't that beautiful? So God within was the final arbiter. But he didn't become angry with those people because he recognized this in truth was God, and it is God's play. So then you see there is a God's play, because you see, it's not possible for you not to hold values, not to have your own opinions or your own ideas or be listening to God's views through yourself. You are a personality. You live in this world. It's not that you become completely rudderless when you are attuned to God. Not at all. Your rudder has never been more sure and more clear in your entire existence than when you are united with God. But the difference between what you see out in the world in God's play and what you know within is clear to you, but you don't have attachment to the outside world in such a way that it binds you through ignorance, that you become so angry, which is really another way of saying, "I am afraid. I'm afraid that the way that things are going in this world will take it away from God." But when you see God as the ultimate power in this universe, and that if and when he chooses to change things, he will. Now, you have a role to play, very definitely, and you must show up to play your role, to say as God speaks through you, to think as God thinks through you, to feel as God feels through you. And when you look at Mother, when you look at Master, when you look at Papa, when you look at Jesus, these are not non-entities. These are not non-personalities. They're strong personalities. They're strong individuals. And they make an imprint upon this world. But it is God's imprint operating through them. Master once said that, "Yogananda, I killed him long ago. He no longer exists." And that he felt and spoke and thought only as God felt and spoke and thought through him. Now, this is a very high state to attain, but it is one that we are all destined to attain. And we cannot do it merely through self-effort. It is God's grace that makes it all possible. A lovely story about Master, the Peggy Dietz, who was a dear disciple to Master. She was his driver through many times, and in telling the story, she talked about Master talking to one of the nuns, and Peggy was sitting behind Master. Master was pacing back and forth in the room and really talking in a strong voice and a loud voice to her. And she was wondering to herself about what the Master was doing, and was he really enraged? And suddenly the Master turned around, he looked at Peggy and he winked at her, and then he turned right back around and he started giving the nun what for. Once again, because that's what she needed in the case. Mother's story about Papa standing behind Papa. And Papa was talking to some of the workmen and doing it in a very strong voice. He sounded angry. And suddenly he turned around and he saw Mother standing there. And Papa said, "Mother, did you think Ram Dass was angry?" And she said, "I don't know, Papa, are you?" He says, "No, it's just how you need to talk to these chaps to get them to do anything." And sometimes you need to do that. There have been occasions when I've been dealing with different people and I've spoken very strongly to them. And the difference is I feel that strength, I feel that power, I feel that energy surging through, but I do not feel out of control. Every word is well-placed barrage against the ego to try to break some kind of trance that they're in. Now, there was only once when Mother spoke to me like that. And I can tell you, I didn't like it. It just put me right down to the floor. But it stands in my memory, and I remember it. And I know that ultimately what she spoke to me, even though at the time I didn't understand it at all, I know now that it was absolute truth, and it was for my good. And there have been multiple lessons that have come from that. So these are the ways that true spiritual masters can operate through this body and operate even through what apparently is what is the downfall for Cain, because that spiritual master is not of the same mind that Cain was. But we have to be careful. We have to be observant of the Cain within us to acknowledge when he shows up, to steer ourselves in a direction that doesn't do harm, at the very minimum to neutralize the feelings and, if possible, create something good out of it. And if we do this and we exercise mastery over these energies as they come up, then we will free ourselves from Cain. We will free ourselves from this materialism, from this body consciousness that Cain represents. He's a central organizing committee, but he's the ego. And when we allow God to be our organizing principle, it takes us to a very different experience. It frees us instead of puts us behind bars of prisons that are made up of ego actions, ego thoughts, and ego words. So let us not be afraid of acknowledging that which is within us, but plainly acknowledge it and then change it. And ask God to help us to uplift it so that we may be true spiritual masters. Pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light.
radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Peace. Bliss.